Okay. So much so that we're forced to ask the question, how does the spin incorporate itself into the superconducting order parameter? So what I'm going to talk about, I'm going to give you an introduction to these new superconductors. And I'm going to talk about composite pairs, the idea describing how a spin incorporates into the condensate. I'll talk a bit about a theoretical development that enables us to treat heavy electron superconductivity at the same time as describing the Kondor effect while still maintaining control of our calculation. And then we'll discuss its application to a simple model of heavy electrons and talk about some of the predictions. Okay. So most of the work I'll talk about today in its recent disguise has been done with my graduate student Rebecca Flint and postdoc Maxim De Zero, but benefited immensely from actually a chance interaction with a particle physics friend of mine, Scott Thomas at Rutgers, and I'll tell you more about that later. Discussion with experimentalists over the recent years, particularly Pasquale Pagliozzo in Unicamp, Joe Thompson and the group at Los Alamos, and Zachary Fisk at UC Irvine. But as I mentioned earlier, an earlier guise of this work can be found in work that I did 11 years ago with Alexei Svelik, Nathan Andre, and Hai Jung. I'll tell you how the current discussion relates to that earlier work. Okay. So why are we talking about heavy electrons? After all, isn't this a bygone field? Aren't we today interested in high-temperature superconductors, Nicktied systems? Why should we even devote research resources to this old and ancient field? Well, I think part of the reason is that these systems bring together many of the topics that are of great interest to us in strongly correlated electron systems. In particular, we see the convergence of magnetism, Fermi liquid behavior, superconductivity, and this is a poster child of such behavior. This is cerium, rhodium, indium 5, a picture due to Tucson Park at Los Alamos, showing how in this system, as you apply pressure, the antiferromagnetism is brought down, and as it hits zero with the quantum critical point, superconductivity forms around the quantum critical point. What's so interesting about this system is that you can actually apply a magnetic field and remove the superconducting dome, and that enables you to look at the nature of the state that is beneath the superconducting dome. In particular, this brings into account the possibility of quantum criticality. Just going back a moment, the point is that just beneath the superconducting dome here, we have a quantum critical point that seems to be driving or nucleating the superconductivity here. There are other systems which I just briefly mentioned, such as ytterbium, rhodium 2, silicon 2. No, it's gone. What happened to it? No, not going to stay. Okay, so much for animations, which I won't talk about very much today. What I want to go on to talk about, however, is the relationship of these systems to other superconductors. And one of the things we're interested in today is finding families of superconductors. Of course, none more famous than the cuprate superconductors, in which we have families of single-layer systems with transition temperatures down in the tens of Kelvin. We have multi-layer systems with transition temperatures around 90 or even up to 150 Kelvin. And of course, we're interested, or we would be interested, in finding the next member of the series. Similarly, in heavy electron systems and intermetallics, in fact, we also have such families. And the systems I'm going to talk about today really belong to the family of so-called 115 systems. In fact, the progenitor of this family is cerium indium 3. Cerium indium 3 was a well-known antiferromagnet back in the early 80s. No one suspected that hidden inside it was superconductivity. But when you apply pressure to cerium indium 3, you lose the antiferromagnetism, and as the magnetism disappears, it develops a 0.2 Kelvin superconductor. This then stimulated the community to think about, well, how can we raise TC? And one of the ideas is that D-wave pairing fits very naturally around the two-dimensional Fermi surface. And this led to the suggestion, or rather the prediction, that if you could make cerium indium 3 more two-dimensional, you'd actually raise TC. And that's what led to the cerium cobalt, the 115 family of superconductors, where TC is running around 2 to 2.5 Kelvin. However, this is the nature of the field, that things that you think should work naturally sometimes lead to surprises. And shortly after the discovery of cerium cobalt indium 5, one of the ideas was, well, let's try and put in an F electron system with a higher energy scale. Let's replace the cerium with an actinide. And so that led to the discovery of plutonium cobalt gallium 5, which has one more order of magnitude in TC. And this system has very many unusual properties, such unusual properties that some of them came to be doubted by other experimentalists. In particular, some aspects of the physics, other than the superconductivity, were not reproduced, in fact, have not been reproduced by Europeans working on the same compound. And I'll tell you what those are, but only last year, a new material came along, this Neptunium, the year before last, Neptunium aluminum 2, palladium 5. And this system also has many properties similar to the plutonium system. In particular, both of these systems display local moment behavior, Curie susceptibility, right down to the point where they go superconducting. So part of the message behind all of this is that one of the reasons it's interesting to work on heavy electron systems is that not that they provide us with high-temperature superconductors, but they enable us to explore rather quickly a large amount of phase space and uncover some of the principles that may be important for families of higher-temperature superconductors. Some have compared these systems to the fruit fly. Of course, the fruit fly was very important in biology to push forward the frontiers of agriculture. I wouldn't have imagined that studying the fly would be interesting to agriculture. However, the point is that it enabled geneticists to understand the properties of plant genetics and genetics in general by being able to breed flies very, very rapidly, long before the discovery of DNA. And in that sense, heavy electron systems help us a lot. And I should add that intermetallics, of course, have become interesting more recently with the rise of the nictide superconductors. And one of the goals that has not yet been achieved in this family is trying to find a d-electron member of that family. And unfortunately, at the moment, no one can make a 115 structure out of d-electron systems close to the point of the magnetic instability. So what's so unusual about these new systems? Let me tell you about them. And by the way, we're such a small group, the best way to continue here is to interrupt. I think it's a good idea to stop me and try and stop me dead in my tracks, and then we'll get more interaction going here. So here are the two structures, theorist idealizations. They're both tetragonal systems, and they both contain local moments. How do we know they have local moments? Well, here's the susceptibility of plutonium, cobalt, gallium 5. Here. And it's easier if I walk this way a little bit. The point about it is that you see a Curie susceptibility all the way down to TC when it goes superconducting. Okay. One of the other interesting things about this system is it has a very, very large specific heat anomaly. And you can actually make the background material with thorium where there's no local moments, and you can make an estimate of the electronic contribution to the specific heat. And of course, as you know, when you integrate C over T with T, you measure the amount of entropy going into the condensate. And you can make a rough estimate it from this area here, and it comes out to be about a third of R log 2. And this is actually a huge amount of entropy. The amount of entropy contained in a single free spin is log 2, and this is one third of that. In fact, most of this entropy is coming from the degrees of freedom of the local moments, the plutonium sites here, which are basically kind of Cramer's doublets. A Cramer's doublet has log 2 entropy, so one third of that log 2 entropy is going into the superconducting condensate, which means that somehow the spins are forming part of the condensate. Moreover, there's no sign in this curve here of those spins quenching to form a paramagnet before the system goes superconducting to form a Pauli paramagnet. It's Curie all the way down, and then bingo, you form the superconductor. Okay. Now, in fact, exactly the same behavior is seen in this slightly lower TC Neptunium system. Again, you see Curie behavior all the way down to the transition at around 5 Kelvin, and bingo, it goes superconducting. And you can also measure the specific heat anomaly in this system, and it's even larger because it's at lower temperatures. And once again, the area here is a large fraction of R log 2. And so these systems taken together suggest that here we have a type of superconductivity in which the local moments quench, develop superconductivity simultaneously. Now, what I haven't shown here is NMR data. NMR data taken by the Japanese and by Nick Currow tell us that these local moments are not present in the superconductor. The superconductor is a perfectly normal, regular paramagnetic system. It has no free spins in it. And so these spins actually vanish as the system goes superconducting. Now, in the background of our field, there are, of course, various theoretical culture wars going on. And one of the culture wars that's out there, it has got the label, what is the glue that produces superconductivity? Or is there a glue? And in this case, if we're going to talk using that language, the spin isn't really so much the glue. It's actually become part of the fabric of the superconductor. And so that's then an interesting question. How can spin become part of the fabric of a superconductor? How can the spins disappear into a singlet system and form the superconducting condensate when spins are manifestly free of any charge degrees of freedom? So what we really need to do is to back off and think about these systems in the context of heavy electron systems. Heavy electron systems are in some sense very simple systems. They're basically lattices of simple local moments interacting with a sea of electrons. And the interaction between those local moments is basically a contact interaction of this sort, which was first studied in detail by Jun Kondo in the 60s. And one of the things he realized was that, in fact, there's a characteristic temperature scale associated with the Kondo interaction. And below this scale, you can no longer do perturbation theory in J. In fact, what actually happens is that the local moment becomes screened by the conduction sea. In fact, perhaps a better way of understanding it is to say that the local moment doesn't get screened, it actually just dissolves into the conduction sea. That spin that was there becomes a mobile spin in the Fermi liquid. And as it dissolves into the Fermi liquid in rather a way that perhaps Michael Faraday would have enjoyed, it forms a mobile charged object we call a heavy fermion. We have lots of evidence for this. We have theoretical backup for that picture. So in some sense, this spin is dissolving as it goes superconducting in these systems. Nevertheless, for a single impurity, what happens as that spin dissolves at low temperatures, what happens is that we get the development of a Pauli paramagnet. And as we cool down to this scale TK, what happens is that what's left behind is a spinless object off which the heavy electrons bounce off. There's a susceptibility of order 1 over TK. And so you have this crossover. The crossover occurs both as a function of temperature and as a function of field. And in fact, is responsible in lattice systems for this remarkable development of coherence at low temperatures and the development of a system where the electrons scatter elastically off each quenched local moment to form a heavy electron Fermi liquid with a characteristic T squared resistivity. But in these systems, that doesn't happen. You don't see the development of the paramagnetic Pauli paramagnet, the Fermi liquid, before it goes superconducting. The specific heat, the susceptibility just climbs on upwards. And it's as if it just goes superconducting around the Kondo temperature. It just skips the intermediate Fermi liquid. And that's then a fascinating question. Is that possible? How can one get a direct transition from a Curie paramagnet to superconductivity? One of the reasons that we hesitated coming back to this problem was because, to this day, the Karlsruhe group, which has reproduced the superconductivity, claims they don't see this upturn in susceptibility. And so the Neptunium system provides an important cross-check of that. It's an unfortunate fact that due to safety considerations, the Los Alamos group have not been able to go back to measuring this susceptibility. They're just about to start this year, okay, after a 7-year hiatus. So we'll get to find out whether that is in fact the case. I firmly believe they didn't make a mistake. The specific heat supports the idea there must be local moments in the normal state. Anyway, the Neptunium system is confirmed, and you also see this feature to some extent in the NMR night shift. Right, of course, that would increase with time. So this was measured fresh. You bake it in the morning, and then you measure it in the afternoon. I think that's what you do with these things. That is true. And in fact, what happens is that over a period of 6 months, TC has gone down by about 1 Kelvin. Okay, but nevertheless, this amount of susceptibility would be very, very severely pair-breaking if this were sort of some other superconductivity against the backdrop. Okay. Very severe anisotropy, actually. This is almost Ising-like, okay? So it's a lot along the C-axis, typically, or maybe in the basal plane in the Neptunium. Okay, so these have got strong crystal field splitting effects, okay? Yes, you get a Curie component of the NMR night shift, but it's smaller than this term here. To me, it looks much more smaller than that. But in the original paper on this, it was claimed that you saw the local moments in both the night shift and in the bulk susceptibility. Yeah. So in fact, one way to try to understand how spins can form a superconductor is the idea of composite pairs, and I'm going to talk about that for a few moments. And in fact, one of the inspirations for this idea really comes from a very unusual direction, that of quantum dots. And in the intervening years since the Kondo effect was discovered and seen to occur in bulk systems, what's become possible is to actually make artificial Kondo effects in tiny quantum dots that contain single electrons. And in these single electron transistors, you see the Coulomb blockade phenomenon, which is that at intermediate temperatures, you find that the conductivity alternates. And actually, in a simple Coulomb blockade system, what happens is that the conductivity drops in between certain resonant conditions, which are when the position of this localized state becomes resonant with the Fermi surface of the leads. But when you have very small quantum dots, something very unusual happens. When the number of electrons in the quantum dot is odd, you form a local moment. And that local moment then undergoes a Kondo effect. It actually, if you like, dissolves into the leads and forms a tiny resonance at the Fermi surface. And that resonance then gives rise to unitary conductance at the lowest temperatures here. Here you have a spin a half. Here you have another spin a half when you've got two more electrons forming. Okay. And so the folks working in mesoscopics have got a very simple way of understanding this tunneling phenomena, and they call it co-tunneling. And the basic idea is that this electron on one lead doesn't cross over to the other one by direct tunneling. It crosses over by co-tunneling. Co-tunneling means that as it hops, it flips the spin, okay, like that, okay? And it just can do that backwards and forwards, and the whole process becomes resonant at low temperatures. That means that when you take an electron from here to here, you don't just create an electron there and destroy an electron here. You create an electron here, and you spin flip at the same time. So if you like, the object you're creating, the object that is delocalized, is a composite object. It's the combination of the creation of an electron and the flip of a spin, okay? And so this idea actually works very nicely to understand heavy electron physics. In fact, you can think of a heavy electron as an electron times a spin flip. There's even evidence that when you probe a heavy electron system with a scanning tunneling probe, the very same physics takes place. Namely, the electrons from that probe can either hop into the conduction sea or they can co-tunnel into the local moment. And so even though there are no low-lying charge fluctuations, an electron can go from a probe into this resonant F state and you see Fanon resonances when you tunnel into a conduct system in this way. So that's what a heavy electron is from this point of view. So if to add a heavy electron, we have to add an electron times a spin flip, then what is the nature of a Cooper pair? So a Cooper pair could be thought of as just two heavy electrons paired together. And that's a very reasonable point of view when TC is much smaller than the Fermi temperature. But when TC becomes comparable with the Fermi temperature, or even bigger than it, then another possibility comes to mind. And this is the possibility that you might form heavy Cooper pairs by literally adding a pair of electrons and flipping a spin. You can kind of think of this as the ultimate consequence of very tightly binding two composite electrons. When you superimpose two composite electrons, the two spin flips will merge into a single spin flip. And so a heavy Cooper pair is then a pair times a spin flip. Okay, so that's all very colorful, but can you write down a model that realizes this physics? And that's been a question that has interested us for quite a long time. And so I'm going to tell you about how we can write down a simple model which we can solve in a controlled limit and illustrate the formation of these composite pairs. It's a model that is motivated by thinking about these highest TC superconductors. So to do this, I'm going to make a theoretical digression. So one of the problems that the theorist faces in trying to deal with strongly correlated electron systems, there's no natural small parameter out there. What we would like to do is to understand the behavior of a system with no natural small parameter. All we understand is that we know how to calculate the partition function as a sum over configurations of the system or trace over the Hammett-Boltzmann partition function. We don't have any natural small parameter in the problem. So one idea is to study families of models in which we can start to control the wild quantum fluctuations that are present in the model of interest. How do we do that? Well, we actually move to models in which we treat families of electron problems in which the electron is treated as having not just two spin components, but n spin components. This large n approach has actually been used over decades to try to solve various difficult problems in statistical mechanics and in particle physics and in condensed matter physics. And the basic idea is that as you increase the number of components of your degrees of freedom, the action or the energy of each configuration will grow with n. And when it grows with n, the fluctuations around the average then start to become smaller, if you like. N can be thought of as 1 over 1 over n. That's a ridiculous thing to say, but of course, when you think about the connection between classical and quantum mechanics, you also sum over configurations weighted by the action divided by h bar. And so 1 over n plays the role of h bar in this problem. As we take n off to infinity, so the fluctuations will start to become quenched and will then be able to look around something that resembles a classical path or a mean field theory. Okay. The trick is to find the right family of models that captures the physics you're interested in. If your large N model, however attractive to you theoretically, throws out some of the key physics, you haven't got a hope in hell of ever recapturing that. Okay. And so that's been a long challenge for the heavy fermion community, because although they could develop large N treatments of the Kondo problem, they couldn't incorporate superconductivity into those controlled approximations. And so we went back to study this. And in fact, our interest was stimulated by a chance remark of a particle physics friend of mine, Scott Thomas. So I was asking him about various groups in particle physics. Every time you let the number of spin degrees of freedom get larger and larger, you're actually exploring a family of groups. And there are various different groups you can look at. And the famous one is the unitary group, the SUN group. So I asked him, well, what about some of the other groups? There's a group called the symplectic group. And I said, why don't you use that in particle physics? It seems just as good as the other one. And he said, well, there's a very good reason for that, that we don't actually, there are no baryons in that theory. And in particle physics, what you have, the physical excitations are n-particle or three-particle bound states of quarks, or quark-antiquark combinations, which are the mesons. And so SUN is absolutely tailor-made for particle physics. We've been using it in condensed matter physics, and the meson of particle physics is our particle Hall pair. But the baryon of particle physics has no natural counterpart in condensed matter physics. And so that aspect of the large N expansion, so useful to the particle physicists, is absolutely useless to us. And what this made us think is, well, can we use a different group which will actually be more useful to condensed matter physics? And that's what I'm going to tell you about. So the whole idea is to find a large N expansion where you can expand various physical properties in powers of 1 over N. So this got us thinking about symmetries. And in particular, got us thinking about discrete symmetries. Because in addition to the rotational symmetry of a spin system, what you also have are discrete symmetries. And one of those at the heart of magnetism is time reversal symmetry. When you form a magnet, you don't just break rotational symmetry, you actually break time reversal symmetry. In fact, an Ising magnet doesn't have rotational symmetry, but it still breaks time reversal symmetry, as does a spin glass. Okay. And this is an important discrete symmetry of the spin that lies at the heart of our understanding of magnetism. The other thing is a spin is neutral. If you make a particle Hall transformation, it doesn't change. Okay. So these two symmetries are at the heart of magnetism and are very important to us. Okay. They're also important for superconductivity, because when you take an electron to form a Cooper pair, what you have to do is to combine an electron in state up with momentum P with its time reverse state, theta of momentum up, spin up is minus P, spin down. And under time reversal, spin inverts, and therefore when you add the two spins together, you get a singlet. Okay? So time reversal lies at the heart of singlet pairing. It's also one of the reasons that that S-wave superconductors are so robust against dirt. Okay. But unfortunately, this symmetry is ruined by the conventional large N expansions. In fact, these discrete parities are not present in the conventional SUN expansion. And as a consequence, there are no singlet combinations of two particles in any of these groups except SU2. And so it's a hopeless task to think that you can actually do a treatment of superconductivity using a large N expansion that just takes advantage of SUN. Okay. This is why the physicists working on heavy electron problems were not able to produce a large N treatment of heavy electron superconductivity. It turns out that restoring the superconductivity of large N expansions requires that we understand the symmetry of time reversal. That's what we have to understand. And so I want to show you how this leads us to a new kind of group. Okay. It's a very simple set of discussions. So basically, we have to think about what happens to a spin when we rotate it and when we time reverse it. So if we take a classical spin, we can first time reverse it, and then we can rotate it, okay? And that's this process here. But we can also, if we like, do the opposite. We can first rotate it, and then we can invert it. And it's an almost trivial statement. Those two processes lead to the same final spin configuration. Now, this property, however, is preserved not just by a classical spin, but by a quantum spin. It's preserved by a spin 1/2 in particular, and by any spin representation of the SU2 group. And that's because, in fact, we can actually do this at the level of unitary transformations. Let's look at what that leads to. It means that we can either do time reversal and a rotation afterwards, or we can do it in the opposite order. These two processes must commute. So you say, well, what's the big deal? Time reversal commutes with unitary rotation. Accepting that you may have this nagging memory of some distant part of your graduate education where you came across this symmetry of time reversal, And it's got something weird about it, because it's not a conventional unitary transformation. Time reversal is actually an anti-unitary transformation. But just for the moment, let's just take this and write it in this form. This tells us if we do a reverse rotation, do a time reversal and a forward rotation, we get the same effect as time reversal. Okay. However, time reversal is actually an anti-unitary operation. And what that means is that it's actually the product of a unitary transformation and a thing which reverses the phase of the wave function. The way you reverse the phase is by taking the complex conjugate. And the operator that takes the complex conjugate is a weird thing. It's often called K. It has the property that every time it hits an amplitude, it complex conjugates it. Okay. Now, that's very odd, because that means that when theta acts on this unitary transformation here, it's also going to complex conjugate it. And when you complex conjugate U dagger, you don't get back to U. You get back to U transpose. And so the net upshot of this is that the consistency between time reversal and rotation leads to this funny condition here. But actually, I sigma 2, which is this, is actually just the anti-symmetric matrix. And so this is a similarity transformation that leads to the anti-symmetric matrix being unchanged. And such similarity transformations are called in mathematics symplectic conditions. And the most famous example of this is classical mechanics, which leaves invariant the Poisson bracket and the time evolution. So what's curious is that the SU2 group has this symplectic condition. And we've got to find groups with larger n, if they exist, that have this property. And it turns out there is a whole family called symplectic groups. They're labeled by SPN rather than SUN. And the interesting thing about them, to cut to the chase, is that we can actually represent their spins in a second quantized way. And here is one such representation. What does this mean? Well, S alpha beta equals F dagger alpha F beta. That's an SUN spin. But what you have here is a peculiar thing in which we've taken the particle hole transformation of the first term here. So alpha tilde here means the sine of alpha. So imagine that alpha here runs from 1 up to n by 2. And there is also alpha that runs from minus 1 to minus n by 2, giving us n components. And so what happens here is we take these components here and we reverse them. This term here gives us a symplectic spin. You can do the same with bosons. Okay. But there is something interesting about this spin operator. I know I'm probably pushing you to your utmost limits here with this digression. Let me just mention something, however, that is very important for this approach, and that is the fact that the pair operator, the operator that creates a pair of electrons, is now, of course, a singlet. We've recovered the fact that we can form a singlet pair of electrons at one site. And therefore, it commutes with the spin operator. One of the weird things about this is that we can write it the other way around. And that's a tautology. But this reads that the spin operator is invariant under particle hole transformations. And since this operator here is the generator of another group, the generator of continuous particle hole transformations, or Bogoliubov transformations, this means that these spin operators have a local symmetry, a local continuous particle hole symmetry, a local SU2 gauge symmetry. And in condensed matter physics, when you're trying to do strong correlation, you always get excited when you have a new gauge symmetry, because gauge symmetries impose the strong constraints of the strong correlation. So what's delightful about this symmetry, this SU2 symmetry not only exists for spin 1/2, but it also exists for all the elements, all the members of these families of SUN groups. And this local SU2 symmetry played a very important role in the early days of understanding RVB superconductivity. In fact, what you can now do is take those approaches and study them in a large N expansion and start to put some control on the problem. Yeah, that's a question there. Can you say that again, please? The problem is the following, is that if you try to set up an operator which you believe describes time reversal, okay, you can divide your spins up into two groups. The SUN spins into two groups. Half of them time reverse and are neutral to charge conjugation, and they are the good part. But the other half don't do that. They, in fact, don't reverse under that operation. They are spins, but in some sense, they're more like dipoles. Okay, they've got a direction to them, but they actually don't reverse under time reversal, and they do reverse under charge conjugation, like a dipole does. So SUN, although it has rotational symmetry, divides up into two groups of operators, generators, the good guys and the bad guys. If you throw out the bad guys, you get back to a smaller group, which is actually the group SPN. Okay? And so that's all we've been doing. We've just been actually crossing out all the bad spins from our models and then continuing. So what that leads to is a set of spin operators which are now particle hole symmetric and have this SU2, local SU2 symmetry. And when you now expand S dot S using the completeness relations or the Fiat equalities, as particle physicists call them, you get new terms which generate a new kind of mean field theory. Okay, that's what you get. Okay. So now let me tell you about the particular mean field theory we developed. Okay. And this will involve talking about a model that we set up, and I know the time is running out, so let me go on. I'm going to talk about composite pairing in the Kondo lattice, and in particular the idea that how to form D-wave pairs in which we combine a spin flip with a triplet combination of electrons. Okay. And, of course, what we're interested in here is a real system. We want to put down a model that makes sense for plutonium, cobalt, gallium-5, and neptunium, palladium, aluminium-5. Did I say gallium? I said plutonium, cobalt, gallium-5. And so this is the basic model we're going to talk about. Normally, when you talk about heavy electron systems, the mechanism for the spin interactions between the local moment and its environment is driven by virtual charge fluctuation. And in particular, if you were to think about plutonium, for example, that has 5 F electrons, and its dominant fluctuation mode is between F5 and F6. Okay, like so. Okay, it could be like that. But what we're going to think about is the possibility of looking at processes which involve both adding an electron and removing an electron. In the simplest models of local moment physics, the Anderson model of local moment physics, those processes, adding an electron and removing an electron, involve an electron in the very same orbital. They involve the very same symmetry, some d doublet, for example. In heavy electron systems, that's not, in fact, the case. In fact, generically, if you, for example, take an empty F state, add one electron to it into the F1 state, it'll go in one particular crystal symmetry. When you add the next electron, generically, the lowest lying state will not allow you to add it in the same symmetry channel. It'll go into another symmetry channel. So we're going to think about a model in which the second electron, when it's added in, goes in a separate symmetry channel to form a singlet. So we have two different singlets that can be reached by virtual charge fluctuations. One in which you, for example, in plutonium, you go from F5 to F6 to form a filled shell, but also from F5 to F4 via a different channel. And these virtual processes mediate then a Kondo model with two Kondo interactions and two symmetries. Here are two possible symmetries we might think about for a tetragonal system. Tetragonal system, a single F electron has J equals 5/2, and you can divide the crystal field states into various Cramer's doublets with different symmetries. You can take the 5/2, 3/2, or the 1/2 doublets, basically. And they look like this, basically. And so we actually thought about a model initially where we take combinations that point to the nearby gallium or palladium atoms, the 5/2 and the 3/2. And these then give rise to two different spin exchange interactions. So here is our model. This is a model that's been around for a long time. And in fact, we thought about it back in 1998 with Hai-Yong Ki. It's a model that dates back to earlier work by Daniel Cox and Mark Jarrell and Pang. And they were interested in models in which J1 and J2 here are actually equal, so-called two-channel condo models. We're interested in models here where J1 and J2 are not equal. So that as an impurity model, in fact, you could just throw away one of these interactions, because what happens for a single impurity is that the strongest channel always wins. The condo effect always takes place in a single channel if one channel is larger. So what we've done is treat this using this symplectic N expansion. We take this spin and write it as a symplectic spin. And when we do that, this is the kind of machinery that takes place. When you expand this term here, you get two terms, a particle hole and a particle particle term. And when you decouple this, it looks like so. And you're then saying, well, does that mean that I've got superconductivity in a single condo effect? And no, because this combination here, because of this local SC2 symmetry, can always be rotated into a single F electron. So pairing, as it looks like, can always be gauged away for a one-channel model. But if I go to a two-channel model, here is now my two-channel model. Now I have two such terms, one for each particle hole and particle particle for each channel. And I can now gauge away the pairing in the first channel, but I will still have to keep the possibility of pairing in the second channel. Now you might ask, well, what does this mean physically? Well, physically, what this means is that when an electron goes into this resonantly scattering state, it now develops Andreev reflection terms. And this is a consequence of the fact that, in fact, this gauge invariant combination of V1 and delta 2 describes the formation of composite pairs. And this is what we figured out back in 1997 for this model, which had no microscopic underpinning and no motivation from experiment. So now this model has a microscopic underpinning, motivation from experiment, and a large N limit. And so we can put it all together. And one of the fascinating things is that this model predicts that when the condo effect develops, the resonant scattering also develops an Andreev component. And that's because an electron can come in like so. Now, if it just resonantly scatters back out in the same channel, it comes out with the very same symmetry. This is electron co-tunneling. Notice, by the way, that this is one of these gamma 7 channels. You notice the hybridization actually has no nodes in any direction, okay? And generically, you don't get nodes in the hybridization of heavy electron systems. Now, you might say, well, why is that? Doesn't the F state have nodes in it? But generically, what you have here is spin orbit coupling. So when an electron comes into a state, it can either go in without spin flipping or go in with spin flipping. Then it comes out and undoes all of that. That then gives it a combination of two wave functions dominating the hybridization. And in fact, those two wave functions are described by this rotation matrix. And the overlap of that rotation matrix with itself then produces an object without any nodes. Okay. However, now we've got to think about the possibility of co-tunneling between two different symmetry channels. In fact, Andreev co-tunneling. And when this can only happen once we form these composite pairs. And so we come in channel one. This is then the anisotropic hybridization, which also allows the spin to flip. And we go out in channel two. And so now what we've got to do is to look at the trace over these two matrices. And when we do that in this particular case, what we discover is that because these two wave functions for the crystal field states are necessarily orthogonal, there have to be nodes in this scattering process. So when you combine these two things, you get this very exotic looking beast here. In fact, this describes a G-wave superconductor. Why is it G-wave? Because actually, this is +5/2, and this is -3/2. So the difference between them is actually 4 units of angular momentum rather than 2, and you don't get a D-wave superconductor. Okay? So that's interesting. The crystal field symmetries determine the symmetry of the paired state. We could have chosen, instead of a 7 and a 7, a 7 and a 6. In fact, we had huge arguments about this when we first wrote down this model and put in the spin-orbit coupling. And we had no very good reason for one or the other. This one seemed to fit the local environment better, so we went with it. But one of the compelling arguments for the 7 times 6 was just multiplication, because 7 times 6 gives you 42. And anyone who knows The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy knows that 42 is the answer to the unknown question. So we were very strongly encouraged to think about 42. And as it now turns out, we probably should have gone for that. It turns out that 42, 6 times 7, gives you a D-wave superconductor rather than a G-wave superconductor. We didn't appreciate that at the time. So anyway, just sticking with this for the moment, this is the pairing that the Dr. Seuss-like phase diagram that comes out of this model. You have two coupling constants, and the ratio determines the type of Fermi liquid you form. If one of them, if J2 is very weak, you get a Cooper instability out of the heavy Fermi liquid way down here. If J1 is very, very weak, you form the Kondo ground state in channel 2, and that later on forms a heavy electron superconductor out of channel 2. But if J1 and J2 are comparable, what happens, the system can actually go rather directly into the composite paired state. It may spend a very brief amount of time in the Fermi liquid, but you won't really see it. The susceptibility won't have time to quench, and it'll go directly into the paired state. The susceptibility will quench as it goes superconducting. There are a number of things that come out of this. One of the interesting things is that the NMR in the approach to the superconducting transition actually has an upturn due to the interference of the Kondo effect in the two channels. And these upturns have been seen for a very long time in both heavy electron and high TC systems. At least in the case of the heavy electron system, we would like to associate them with the formation of composite pairs. This then leaves us with a nagging and embarrassing problem. So we've now accounted beautifully for the plutonium and the neptunium system. But after all, historically, these systems were discovered by thinking about cerium systems. And the cerium 115 systems delighted the community because they are so close to antiferromagnetism. And so antiferromagnetism clearly plays a role in the pairing here. So how can we then unify the magnetically mediated pairing with our composite pairing system? This is something we've been doing, trying to understand recently. We've been trying to develop a model for the cerium 115 systems. And this is really work in progress, but let me tell you about what we have done here. Okay, so in particular, one of the things that caught our eye was the fact that, if you look at the susceptibility of cerium cobalt indium 5, it actually has something rather interesting. In the most pure compounds examined, it has this beautiful upturn in the susceptibility just before it goes superconducting. And so to us, that looked like the very same phenomenon that we've been seeing in the plutonium systems. In fact, we tried to understand this physics here. And so we wanted to know whether we could understand this as another example of composite pairing. But of course, that then leads us to a dilemma, because the community believes the pairing in the system is driven by magnetic pairing. So in fact, one of the things that we spent some time doing was to think about what crystal field environment would give rise to this upturn here. You can see that what's going on here is that actually you have a transition from a state with a large Weiss temperature, Curie-Weiss temperature, and a large moment. And what then happens is at this point, you get a crossover to a much smaller moment. And the reason you see that much smaller moment is because you must have a much smaller Weiss temperature to reveal it. And so what that means is that presumably the lowest lying doublet in this system is actually the smallest moment component of the crystal fields. And you can get a good fit to this crystal field crossover here by assuming that you have a 5/2 excited state and a 1/2 low-lying state. This is then the 6 times 7 combination. And in fact, so what we've done is we've looked at a model which contains both magnetic pairing and composite pairing. So we've really got two axes here. One is the axis where we put in a second channel Kondo coupling, And that gives us this peak in the composite pairing here. But now we want to explore what happens when we turn on magnetic pairing. So what we've done is first you can turn on the magnetic pairing. This gives you also a peak in the TC. What do you have here? On this side, you have a Fermi liquid. On the other side, you have basically an RBB state, a spin liquid. Okay. Up here, in reality, you'd actually have magnetism in a mean field theory. What's so very interesting is that we've discovered that composite pairing and RBB pairing actually have a linear coupling in the Landau-Ginzburg theory. If you like, the moment you create a D-wave pair, you're generating composite pairing at the site of the local moment. Or if you turn on composite pairing at that site, you generate D-wave correlations at the neighbors. And so what this then means is that when we actually do a joint mean field, we don't just see these terms overlapping without seeing each other or suppressing one another. In fact, they do the exact opposite. They actually enhance one another. So that if you start with a pure composite paired state and turn on the magnetic pairing, you climb up the contour to higher TC. Or if you start with a state with pure magnetic pairing and turn on the composite pairing, you also climb up to a higher TC. And so these two processes actually cooperatively interfere with one another. That's really the end of my story, and I wanted to recap and tell you some of the conclusions. One of the conclusions is one that's of interest mainly to the condensed matter theorists, which is that symplectic spins enable us to do a 1 over n expansion for heavy fermion superconductivity. And we believe that you can also use these very same methods for one band models, and it's something of great interest to us at the moment. Okay? It predicts in this rather simplistic way avoided criticality, in this case, an avoided criticality associated with the two-channel Kondo physics. Even if you're away from this point, you can get an enhanced TC as the system tries to avoid this singular point where the system jumps from one Fermi liquid to another. Composite pairing is really a form of resonant Andreev scattering. And although I haven't had time to mention this, there's something very interesting here, because actually in high TC, it's well known that when you replace the copper by zinc, TC plummets like a brick. And that's because you destroy the D-wave pairs at nearest neighbor sites. One of the little secrets of heavy electron superconductivity is that the same thing happens if you put disorder between the spins. But quite often, if you take out the spin and put in something else, like a lanthanum or a gallium atom, which has a spin that doesn't interact with the community, actually TC doesn't go down very dramatically. In fact, in cerium, cobalt, indium 5, you can get 60% ytterbium replacing the cerium, and TC only goes down by 1 Kelvin. And this is a very odd thing, because you should create huge amounts of scattering by taking out that spin. One of the interesting things is, however, that what happens when you take out that spin is that you create a hole in the background. That hole, that Kondo hole, not only resonantly scatters, it presumably also resonantly Andreev scatters. So actually, it compensates for the scattering it's first created. And we have some indications from playing with this theory that the conventional Abrakozov-Gorkov theory of pair breaking doesn't quite work for Kondo holes. In fact, the Andreev scattering they generate may compensate for the strong resonance scattering they also produce. And so we're hopeful this may be one way to try and explore the possible physical reality of this model. It predicts an enhancement of 1 over T1 above TC. And here's another aspect of that idea of resonant Andreev reflection. What we'd like an experimentalist to do is to do something crazy like dope the cerium systems with plutonium. And we think that there's a chance that in one of these doping scenarios, that as you dope it with the other ion, you'll actually find TC doesn't go down, but might actually go up. And that would be a smoking gun confirmation of this basic mechanism, we believe. It's a bit of a gamble, but we think it's worth looking at. And that's it. Thank you. Yes. Yeah. Right. Yeah, so that's a very interesting possibility. For example, could one take oneself over the top by going between the Neptunium and the plutonium system? Unfortunately, we only have three metals to play with in this game at the moment, and two of them are not very nice for any lab to play with. Although people tell me that Neptunium is actually much easier to deal with than plutonium. So that would be one possibility. Of course, pressure has been extensively used in these systems, in the cerium 115s. There, typically, we're very close to the magnetic quantum critical point. And so really, it would be alloying or playing with those other combinations that might be particularly interesting. The plutonium system doesn't have any magnetic versions. So if you take the 115s made of plutonium, you never see any antiferromagnetism, interestingly enough. So as you tune from rhodium to cobalt, TC changes, but it remains a superconductor. Curiously enough, what happens is that it becomes more Fermi liquid-like as you go from cobalt to rhodium. And if you go from cobalt to iridium, you just form a boring vegetable. So it is a bit mysterious. This system with the higher TC has no nearby magnetism. There should be some somewhere. It would be interesting to find out if we can bring it back in. Yes. It's not so accidental, though, because actually in cerium, and probably in plutonium too, although we don't know much about it, in cerium we can certainly see the two states for going from F1 to F0 and F1 to F2. They're rather nearby with one another, and so J1 and J2 could be roughly comparable. The same thing is also possible, we know less about it, for the plutonium system. It does require a coincidence. There is one interesting angle on this, though, because one case where there is much more asymmetry between the two charge fluctuations is the ytterbium. And ytterbium shows lots of magnetism and heavy electron behavior. But until just last year, there were no examples of ytterbium heavy fermion superconductors. And the only one that's known to date has a transition temperature of about 20 millikelvin. And so one of the mysteries is why you have the same amount of magnetism on both sides, F13 and F1, why you see heavy electron behavior in both cases, but you don't see superconductivity in the ytterbium, and you do see it in many cerium systems. And so one possible explanation is that the fluctuations from F13 to F12 are much, much weaker in ytterbium because that state is much further away, electron volt, many electron volts away from the Fermi energy than the state where you go from F13 to F14. And so that is one possible aspect of this model that might help us explain one of the mysteries of heavy electron superconductivity. Well, they would have, those two Fermi liquids would have very different Fermi surfaces, because you're using a different crystal field channel to create the heavy electron Fermi. So they're very different symmetries, if you could go between them. Or you might find that in the, another thing you might find is that in the dilute limit, you'd be very close to two-channel Kondo physics. You might find that if you could pressurize the dilute limit, you might be able to push yourself from one side to the other, perhaps. But they would have two very different symmetries there. Of course, what would typically happen is one will win, but perhaps you could tip it from one side to the other using pressure or something. It's a tall order, but maybe. Yeah. That's right. Yes. The only choice? Well, it does seem to be the unique choice if you want to preserve time reversal symmetry. In fact, what we have really shown is that the consistency of time reversal and rotation requires symplectic symmetry. So yes, it is the only choice that will preserve time reversal symmetry. It's the only choice if you want to do a large N expansion and keep singlet Cooper pairs. Thank you.